Good evening, everyone, and welcome to this event, a Hamilton moment for Europe, demystifying the next generation EU and the EU recovery funds, hosted by the LSE European Institute. I'm Dr. Corrado Macchiarelli, and I'm a visiting fellow in European political economy at the LSE European Institute. I'm delighted to be chairing the event today and delighted to welcome our speakers. Before I do, I have a few housekeeping announcements. For those Twitter users in the audience, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSENGEU. The event is being recorded and will hopefully be made available as a podcast subject to no technical difficulties. Our event will consist of presentations from our speakers, followed by a discussion Q&A with the audience. When we come to the Q&A portion of our event, please use the Q&A feature at the bottom of the screen. Questions will be submitted to myself, and I will pose as many as possible to our speakers. Please do let us know your name and affiliation when you ask a question. So the panel today will explore the design and implementation of the Next Generation EU Fund, weighting both the positive and the negative, and pausing where improvements might be needed. As we all know, the Next Generation EU program represents a landmark agreement and is changing the way the EU finances itself. Has never had the European Commission borrowed such a large scale and maturity on financial markets. So based on a wide array of experiences, the panel will explore how the NGU could be implemented to focus on the effectiveness, efficacy, and sustainable ways of spending in the EU, successfully mobilize private sector funding, as well as deliver the promised medium to long-term benefits in terms of convergence, complexity, and higher growth across the EU. Now, to introduce our speakers, I'm extremely delighted to be joined by Ines Rocca, who is EBRD Managing Director of Impact and Partnership. She's worked at the EBRD since 2005 in a variety of positions, such as Director for Financial Products on the SMEs Finance and Development. And prior to the EBRD, Ms. Rocca worked as an economist at the Central Bank of Portugal. Professor Anthony Bartsokas is a visiting professor in practice at the LSE Hellenic Observatory, associate professor at the University of Athens, and former EBRD Board Director of Greece. Vedrana Giuselis Kazic is a member of the management board of the second largest bank in Croatia, former partner of Deloitte Financial Advisory Services, and former EBRD director for Croatia, Slovenia, Hungary, and Slovakia. And last but not least, Dr. Frank Nefke is a team leader at the Complexity Science Hub Vienna and a former research director of the Growth Lab at Harvard Center for International Development. Ines, given your experience at the EBRD, both as managing director in the vice presidency in charge of the RRF engagement of the bank, as well as your previous operational role, what do you think the major challenges are of successful impact for this new European initiative?
Thank you. Thank you, Corrado. And I'm really delighted to be in you know such panel with you know also my former colleagues, which I'm delighted to see here today. So thank you so much for the invite. Before I go into you know what would make this program successful, I would want just to give a little bit more color and background to the EU's Next Generation EU program and the Recovery Resilience Facility, you know, the RRF, as we call it, and also building a little bit on, you know, the active role which my team here at EBRD is and will continue to be playing in the implementation of the program in most of our EU countries of operation, from Baltics to Greece via Bulgaria and Romania. So the Next Generation EU was the result of really a game-changing decision of the European leaders to use the borrowing power of the European Commission to channel resources to boost the economic recovery from COVID. So, you know, we can't forget that this was all sort of to boost economy post-COVID. We are now facing other challenges, but, you know, at the time, this was really a COVID response, while also addressing, you know, some of the long-term policy priorities, which are very much aligned with what we do here at EBRD, and particularly on green and digital. And, you know, the market's reaction has been very positive, and the European Commission has actually been able to issue several successful bond issuances since June last year, with a strong oversubscription. And new member states are engaging with the likes of EBRD, but also, you know, EIB and some of the national promotional banks to assist with know-how and financing capacity to deliver a part of this recovery and resilience plan. So each country must present their plans to the European Commission and Council and gain the support for the programs to become effective. And the RRPs must meet a number of conditions, key among which but are supporting the achievement of the country's policy reform priorities identified in the European semester process. So, for example, in a minimum of 37% green, a minimum of 20% digital, we mentioned, you know, these bigger sort of overarching priorities. They have to also comply with EU competition and state aid rules and respect the do no significant harm principle connected to climate and environment. And the RRF comprises 100% of grants, 80% of loans available for a total of 724 billion. So we're talking about, you know, big power here in terms of financing. And up to now, only seven countries in the entire EU 27, but out of which, you know, four are actually within EBRD's region, have requested loans for a total of 166 billion euros. Out of 386 billion, which is available. But more countries can do so actually until August 2023. And the decision to actually take the loans by these countries is largely based on the cost of funding. So the countries will, you know, look at their own cost of funding versus bond emissions, and as well as the financing needs that that they need to address. And the large majority of the EU financial support will be front-loaded. So 70% of the RRF grants actually have to be committed by the end of this year. And the remaining RRF grants can be committed by next year. And the entire RRF loans will be spread from second part of 2021 to the end of 2026. Now, concerning the RRF grants, the large projects are usually included ex ante with some level of detail in the country's recovery and resilience plans, while the smaller projects that are part of the broader investment plan might be selected through public tenders or similar procedures. And while most, if not all, countries in Southern, Western, Northern Europe have already started the implementation of the EU recovery plans, with Spain, Italy, France, and Greece having already received the second tranche of funds following the achievement of the first set of milestones. Actually, EBRD's countries of operation in Central, Eastern, and Southern Europe progressing at very different speeds with the plans, and with Bulgaria, Poland, and Hungary still waiting, actually, to receive the Commission's and the Council's green light. But the RRF, you know, represents a major one-off funding opportunity for EBRD's EU countries' operations. And, you know, they will receive about 97 billion of EU grants expected and 41 billion of EU concessional loans due to lower GDP levels, higher unemployment rates, you know, impact of the pandemic overall. And some of the countries have requested the EBRD's engagement in delivery of the RRPs and have recognized that, you know, EBRD in terms of, there's a strategic alliance in terms of what we can do, and we can assist in delivering the policy objectives as well. Now, the most concrete engagement that the EBRD has received so far and their RRF has been in Greece. And so we're delighted actually to be involved in this. And this is through the corporate loan facility. And the program will combine up to 500 million of RRF concessional loans managed by the EBRD and up to 500 million of EBRD commercial financing and financing from private investors and you know, in general, sort of on a commercial basis. And we at EBRD signed an operational agreement with the Greek Ministry of Finance in just very recently in November 2021. Now, eligible projects will need to contribute at least to one of the five strategic pillars identified by the Greek authorities. And this is, you know, green transition. We mentioned green is a very important part of it. Digitalization, extroversions, economies of scale, and innovation, giving a clear policy steer in terms of deployment of the RRF funds in Greece. And the Greek RRF facility is unique insofar, and promotes financial discipline by private sector financial beneficiaries, which then have to pay back the loans, but also encourages proper risk assessment by EBRD or other entities. And we really and leverages RRF funds through co-financing with at least our own resources, potentially to be also syndicated. And you asked me, you know, specifically, where do I see the major chances of the successful impact? Now, I would say that, you know, the RRF funds can really complement EBRD's action, especially in sectors where investments are needed and with a significant grant contribution. I mean, we talked about, you know, green, but e-mobility via electric vehicle, you know, charging station, just to give you an example. And where grants can speed up the scale of investments. So I would say, you know, some examples of these typical sectors where EBRD intervention can help in scaling up this, these activities could be for so green growth, financing renewable energy, electricity storage projects, you know, green cities, energy efficient buildings renovation, which is, you know, at the core of what EBRD does, accelerating, you know, digital transformation, and financing R&D and innovation projects. And these priorities are very much aligned also with EBRD's strategic capital framework, which set up green and digital as our key priorities for 2021 to 2025. So I'd stop at that. I know I've given you quite a lot of information to digest, but over to you, Arad.
Thank you very much, Ines, for this excellent introduction. Anthony, you have a quite different perspective on this new European initiative being now in academia. So how do you see the current design and initial implementation of the Next Generation EU? And where do you see the largest implementation gaps in particular? And if I may also, if we can compare that to the previous experience with European structural and investment funds, for instance, what do you think the lessons learned could be from those previous experiences, Anthony?
Thank you, Corrado. And we're making a very good start because Ines already covered the kind of operational side of how things work. So if you don't mind, I'll share my screen and then we can go on.
Please, yeah.
Can you see it? So what I would like to do in order to address your questions is first I will provide a general overview of the new generation EU and EU recovery funds. And the focus there is really to move from the operation side to a more analytical perspective and try to understand what are the novelties in this initiative. And then my second slide, I will stick to two slides. My second slide would be a kind of framework trying to address your three questions. You remember you asked us three specific questions, so I will try to address these questions. And the point is that, and my argument is that I think that by focusing on these questions, we can really have an economic analytical perspective on how things should work in a way. So let me start with an overview of, you know, what are the novelties. First, you already mentioned that EU already had for years grants and loans programs, but it's for the first time that EU is tapping the capital market in order to fund this new initiative. And this is a novelty by itself. It is important for everybody to understand that what we have now in operation is the product of a compromise. And there have been three levels, three areas of compromise. One, the debate on the fiscal dimension. Second, the debate on the rule of law. And third, the policy, the forward-looking dimension. It is important to understand that this compromise, led to dropping, for example, the equity fund, which was initially in the EU planning mindset, and also the liability sharing of the debt is not exactly mutualization. Now, what are the novelties? One very important novelty that we will see in the future is that the conditionality. For the first time, and very different from the EU budget, conditionality is embedded in the implementation of the program. Second, you already mentioned that markets have welcomed this initiative. This is true. And also, there is already some research on the signaling effect of announcements related to fundraising for EU recovery fund. And it's quite important. Another issue that Ines alluded to is that we have seen distinctive policy mix trajectories. Some countries are going for loans, some countries are going more for grants or explicitly for grants. Another thing that really I find very interesting and kind of timely is that the program itself has a kind of fine-tuning mechanism. Countries are allowed in the process to adjust to challenges. And this, in the days that we live and the challenges that we live, is very important. It's very important for green, it's very important for resilience. It's a really topical issue. Couple of things to finish with the overview. There was a huge and painful debate on, to what extent the European Union can really withdraw support from member states when they don't obey the rule of law principles. And that has been kind of confirmed with the recent European Court decision. Finally, I think that, again, from an analytical perspective, it's always important to look back at what is the history and the experience of cohesion funds in order to understand the potential and perhaps the obstacles of this new initiative. And I would say that there are three important legacy issues that we need to keep in mind. First, EU cohesion policy implementation has several problems related to lack of timely implementation. Second, at the country level, we can see limited project upstream capacity. And finally, the substitution effect. Sometimes EU cohesion funds have been used instead of public budget. That would be my overview. Now, let me turn to the substance. And what is this initiative about? And to what extent it can be improved. As I said before, I will focus on your three questions. The first question was on focus. The second question was on scale, how we're gonna scale up. And the third question was on impact. When I look at focus, to what extent this program is focused enough? My context is the selection process itself. And in this selection process, I can identify two different phases. One is the design of priorities. It has already been done. And second is to what extent we can identify implementation gaps. So in terms of design priorities, national plans have been approved on the basis of top-down objectives. But when it comes to implementation, what we have seen is thematic clusters with limited micro considerations. And that leads me to compare what we see to what is happening in the policy industry at large, broadly. And I would say that by having thematic clusters with limited micro consideration, we are missing important dimensions of how we move from incentives to output and impact. Is there a policy implication that we need to consider on the basis of this analysis? I would say yes, and the policy implication is that we need to monitor very carefully funding gaps in a kind of open data platforms perspective. My second point is I'm trying to address your second question on scale. It is clear that this program is really aiming at scaling up with market-based solutions. And they are doing that with two important considerations. One is that you need to bring down the cost of capital. And second, you need to bring in financial institutions and IFIs. And these are novelties. I would say that when it comes to implementation gaps, what we have seen is the cost justification of thematic clusters is the weakest part and the weakest process that we have seen so far. What is the best practice? The best practice from my point of view is try to adopt as much financial innovation as possible. And I would say the fact that you bring in IFIs is a golden opportunity for that. Overall, when it comes to policy implications, I think that the program so far is really focusing primarily on cost of capital without looking at other, say, areas of risk mitigation. And I would recommend a more balanced approach for risk appetite and risk mitigation in the fine tuning of the programs as they process. My comments on your third question, which is about impact. The context I have when I think about impact is structural change. And you, Corrado, have done some work on this, and I'm not going to expand, but it is important to make clear that this program is taking structural change seriously, and they look at resilience, which is a very important concept for the design of the program itself. But when it comes to complementarities, implementation gaps, these are still very weak in the way the program has been designed. What we are lucky with is that fine tuning is embedded. So I would say when it comes to policy implications, I see two important policy implications going forward. The first is that we need to focus more on lower productivity segments of the market. And second, we need to look at how the current ambition for a more proactive European policy on energy and green will be integrated in the program itself as it evolves. What I mean by that, I mean that energy and green is a very important component of the initiative, but market signals will change dramatically in, say, months to come. So we need to see how this will be incorporated. I will stop there. I have some further ideas about how all this can become more concrete in terms of country level proposals, but I can take a second round for that. Thank you, Corrado.
Thank you very much, Anthony. Yes, definitely we'll go back to some of these points and very happy to expand during the discussion that will follow. I'd like to go to Vedrana, and Vedrana, you have quite a unique experience in terms of both working in international financial institution at the operational level, as well as more recently in the private sector. So in that sense, you have that point of view which looks at different points. What was your experience co-financing with the European Structural Investment Funds, given that most of these funds have had poor absorption in the past and sometimes lack bankable projects? Do you think the new EU recovery and resilience funds will be different in terms of effectiveness, efficiency, and sustainability? So following on from what Anthony was saying.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And dear chair, dear panelists, LSE European Institute and virtual audience, very pleased to be here with you to discuss this unprecedented support that the member states have at their hands, I think, which comes at the moment, which is critical, seeing the Ukrainian-Russian conflict. So imagine us being in this situation without having this support, which is targeting and helping to make the economies much more resilient and to focus the investments into the sectors where it is most needed. And as we can see, it is really within the green, within the energy sector, to make the European economy less reliant on the Russian sources of energy. So I would say the timing is really very, very strong. It is often compared to the Huffington moment, but we have a very different political and macroeconomic circumstances. But we can say that definitely this is a strong sign of the European unity and the ambition. So given the current conflict, we are sensing this high level of unity. So we can say that as the pandemic exposed Europe's economic vulnerabilities, that Russia-Ukraine crisis has exposed its geopolitical, so it will demand a similar collective response. Discussions are ongoing whether the new debt would be raised for this, which specific purpose, but this is yet to be seen because there are different views at the moment, but the thinking is that such support is needed. And based on the initial estimates, the estimate is that the next generation EU investments could contribute in the EU 27 for approximately 1.5% higher GDP. As Ines said, the special attention needs to be paid to the Central and Eastern Europe because some countries are lagging behind, not only in their vaccine rollout, but also in their readiness to use the EU recovery fund. So they really need to address deeply the structural reforms which are related to COVID in order to close the gap with the more competitive EU economies. If we come to the comparison with regards to the European structural and investment funds, and what is it that we have learned? With regards, we can say that the experience which I have had working at EBRD for more than 20 years, that both EBRD and the EIB group, they have both lent in parallel to the European structural and investment funds. They also manage few financial instruments, concession loan, funding guarantees. So as you have indicated in your question, such experience has not always delivered to the initial expectations, and there were several reasons for that. One was cumbersome monthly reporting requirements, then also the lack of coordination between the EU co-funded programs and the national programs. Also the lack of bankable projects, which would often require lots of technical assistance for the preparation and the implementation support. Then there is also the legacy of a poor absorption capacity from managing authorities, which would have required improvements in the quality of government and also the enhancement of the administrative capacity alongside the simplification of the procedure. So this experience of the European structural and investment funds in the previous period, it has served as a lesson in the design of the recovery funds, which now have the following advantages that need to be translated from design to implementation, although we have already seen the first disbursements, and the most of the disbursements will come in the first year or two. So the main difference is that now the funds are performance-based, and there is a clear set of reforms and investments milestone, which will create the incentives for the EU member states to deliver on their recovery and resilience plans commitments. So the funds are very much linked to the commitments of the national governments to follow what were the country recommendations of the European Commission, which is very much important to make the whole Europe stronger, because there are many, many gaps, I would say, particularly with regards to the green energy, but also with regards to the productivity, access to the capital markets, the gaps that would need to be narrowed down. Also now what is much more specific compared to the previous instruments is that there is a clear focus on the green and the digital digital agenda. And I would say that particularly in the current circumstances of the Russian-Ukrainian conflict, that the green agenda is of utmost priority, particularly going for the quicker wins, focus on the energy efficiency, resource efficiency, focus on the buildings, trying to make the transition of the household to be less dependent on the gas and on the fossil fuels. So this is definitely the advantage. And also the current regulation is lighter than the common provision regulation in terms of reporting and also administration requirements. So there is a hope and intention that this will create more autonomy to implementing partners, also to set up their own management fees and the financial structure. Also at the end to emphasize that this is a critical issue, especially for the European Southern and Eastern periphery in the new programming period, as public and private investments should be a catalyst to help revive the economic recovery and also help the dynamics for the greater European integration. Of these countries, what is very interesting is that the Southern European countries that were particularly in the focus during the previous sovereign debt crisis, such as Italy, Spain, and Greece, they have emerged in a very positive light. They were first whose programs were recognized by the EU Commission, and they were actually praised for the high quality and also the high level of their ambition in terms both of the investments and the policy reforms. So these countries, they have practically been at the forefront, and they are one of the largest recipients. So to end the answer to your question, I would say that practically this previous experience in implementing the far-reaching reforms in front of the market and the institutional creditors during the euro area sovereign debt, it's actually served as the certain lesson how the southern economies have actually taken seriously Commission requests to allocate the EU funds efficiently. So we are hoping also that this moment of the positive European unity will also bring together the policy stakeholders in fulfilling the commitments which they have given in their plans. And furthermore, in the first months of this year, they have also been quite eventful for the number of the countries. And also Spain, France, Italy, and Greece, they have all received the positive Commission's preliminary assessments for their second now payment requests. So I would say that requests also for the subsequent tranches, they are based on achievement of several milestones, which cover reforms and investment in various areas. And these areas are very specific and they are tailor-made for each country, but the themes which are, I would say, are repetitive in most of the member states, they relate to the energy efficiency, to the balancing of the energy related to the peaks in the renewable energy production, into the waste management, looking also at the business environment, and also how to improve the healthcare and the public transport. So I would say that all this together, it needs to be paid special attention to the Central and Eastern Europe, because some countries, as we are well aware, they are lagging behind in the preparation for the use of the EU recovery funds, and let alone also the implementation of the funds which are linked to the achievement. So it is likely to be important test for the EU institution to check the coherence of this European project. But I would say the timing is really very, very good given the situation in which the global economy, in particular the European economy, is challenge given the conflict which is ongoing and which is likely to have serious consequences to the global economy, and particularly Europe, if you are looking at the energy prices, supply chain, food chain, and all the links. So the program is really designed to make the European economy more resilient. And the good news is that the funds have already started being channeled to the national economies. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Vedrana. You touched on a number of interesting points in making EU economies more resilient, not particularly now as now you talked about energy efficiency, and now that resonates very strongly with the Russian-Ukraine conflict. But also you touch upon structural reforms and countries that were at the core of the sovereign debt crisis, and how now they've leading in by example in terms of applying to these funds and putting together national plans. And I like on that note to take a step back and go to Frank. Frank, you've been a former director of a extremely important, very distinguished growth lab at Harvard. You're now leading on complexity. So what has complexity to do with that? And what do you think, in terms of growth and growth potential, we could achieve by, you know, sort of a joint funding structure such as the one that Europe has put in place?
Right. Well, first of all, thank you for having me in this event. It's I'm very excited to be here in this panel, and I think it's maybe it's helpful to start by explaining what complexity actually means in this context, because it's one of these words that you can use in so many ways that it's helpful to maybe put some definitions down, and then I'll try to explain how that framework actually might help to think through spending in Europe. So economic complexity starts from the is a way of trying to understand why certain places produce certain things. So when I'm talking about structure and structural transformation, then I really mean like the kind of industries that a place or a country is active in and how that changes. So that kind of transformation of your productive structure. Now, there are two central assumptions if you look at this kind of work, and that is that, you know, production is not just putting capital and labor together with some technology, but rather you need to have many, many different inputs. And there is absolutely no rate of substitution between these inputs. That might sound extreme, but think of inputs like if I want to make a car, I need a car engineer, and I need a mechanic, and I need an accountant, and I need a whole lot of different things. I might actually need certain institutions that help me. I need research institutes, infrastructure, what have you. And there is no rate of substitution between a car engineer and an accountant. So I cannot hire 20 accountants instead of one car engineer. So that's sort of the model that you're thinking of. What that implies is that you can think of an economy as possessing certain capabilities, just like maybe one metaphor to fix ideas is Scrabble. So if you want to play Scrabble, then you have a set of letters, which are these capabilities. And at the same time, there are some products, like think of words in the Scrabble game, that you could produce if you have the right letters. So this view of the world means that countries can produce certain things if they have the right capabilities. Now, these capabilities are constraining of not just the kind of things that you can do, but also how wealthy you can get, because the productivity is very much related to the kind of things that you're doing in your economy. So you typically don't necessarily need to see the capabilities. You can infer all of that by looking at which countries make which things or which cities are active in which types of industries. So you can get a good sense of, for instance, which products require similar capabilities by looking at which products are often co-produced. And you can also try to get a good sense of how many capabilities a city has or a country has by using the main intuition is that places are complex if they can do many things, and especially if these things are not done by many others. So if very few places can do what you can do, then you often have a complex economy. Now this complexity turns out to be you can show that it's a sort of a measure of how close you are to the technological frontier, and it's very strongly related with GDP per capita. So here you see the scatter of GDP per capita against complexity, complexity on the horizontal axis, GDP per capita on the vertical axis. You see the top countries in Europe, Germany leading, Czech Republic, Austria, Sweden, on the bottom, and you have places like Portugal, Bulgaria, Cyprus, Greece. One thing that is important here is that complexity, so in this graph, the further you are away from this predicted income that you have, so the higher your income is vis-a-vis what you should have based on your complexity, the more likely it is that you actually shrink in terms of GDP per capita. If you're below this regression line, you tend to grow. So deviations from in your income from what your complexity can actually maintain are predictive of future growth. And then you can do growth. You can actually try to predict growth. And this is something that the Growth Lab did a lot. These are predictions from right before the pandemic until 10 years later. And you see that there's actually quite a bit of difference in the growth opportunities, given the complexity that countries had in 2017. So you see that Germany is already so complex that it cannot grow that much faster. So there is some convergence. The richest countries will not grow that fast. But you see a lot of heterogeneity in the countries that are at somewhat lower levels of complexity. So you see some Eastern European countries that have a lot of potential within the complexity that they have and they could easily develop. But other countries like Bulgaria and Greece actually have still rather low levels of complexity and would need, therefore, to change the economic structure if they want to reach the productivity levels and the average productivity levels of Europe and get this convergence going. So from an economic complexity point of view, what you need to do depends a little bit on where you are. So the places that need to raise their complexity, they somehow need to acquire new capabilities. And that's actually very hard, but there are some ways to do that because most of these capabilities tend to be embedded in the labor force, in people and in teams of people. So acquiring new capabilities often is done by making sure that you get people with capabilities to move to your region. And this is a very well-known fact in literature on migration. You see that high-skilled workers, if you attract them to your region, that's great. But recently, we also found that lower-skilled workers can have a huge impact if they move from more advanced to less advanced economies. So for instance, in Albania, when the financial crisis hit, many Albanians had to return home from Greece. And it turned out that instead of lowering wages and employment growth, they actually created new employment and higher wages in the places where they returned, purely because the kind of activities that they were active in were like agriculture and so on. But they learned in Greece how to use greenhouses, and they implemented that in Albania. And Albania, these Albanian farms were relatively productive compared to the economy that was there. And it actually led to new exports and growth. So this is important in the European context because we have so many people who have moved to other places, are embedded in more advanced economies, and they are real assets if you want to acquire new capabilities. The other thing is if capabilities are so complex that they are actually not held within a single individual, you may need to somehow get teams of individuals to move. And that's one way of looking at FDI. So FDI is a very important aspect of this convergence in complexity. Foreign firms have been shown to be training institutes, but they can also kickstart really new technologies. But it's not necessarily any foreign firm. You need to have the foreign firms that fit your current kind of profile and that are willing to engage with your economy. So what we found, for instance, is that if you invest in getting FDI from the lead firms in the economy, they have such a strong internal network that they actually don't create much spillovers to your local economy. They actually they actually isolate themselves very much from the economy where they end up. So why am I saying this? Well, there's actually a lot that you that still needs to be done when you're thinking about attracting people and firms to your country. So this is to illustrate that. I show you here two maps, manufacturing in Europe and the German FDI in manufacturing. So these are on the left-hand side, you see where manufacturing is. And on the right-hand side, you see where Germany actually invested in manufacturing. And as you can see, it all bunches up along the German border. That is to say that this FDI actually doesn't travel very far. And that makes it very hard for a country like Bulgaria to attract German FDI because it is still, distance is a limiting factor. It's actually, we spoke about Ukraine. The Ukrainian economy, if you look at the center of gravity, which is what this graph shows, it actually moved eastward, southeast, until in the 1990s until 2005 with the Orange Revolution, and then started to move to the northwest. And that's to a large extent driven by a move towards the Western economy and Western firms investing, not anywhere in Ukraine, but very close to where they actually were from. So this distance, you might think it doesn't matter anymore, but it does. Now, on the other hand, we have new activities that actually are much more footloose. So this is a really cool work by Johannes Bax and his co-authors at the Wirtschaftsuniversität in Vienna. They looked at where open source is happening. And it turns out that open source is very, very concentrated. So open source, you can do it from your own home, somewhere on the mountains, but it turns out that people are flocking to specific places. So for instance, Berlin has a concentration of open source developers that is comparable to Silicon Valley, but then very quickly it drops off. And there are very few places in Europe that play a role. Now, what is interesting about open source is that you can access open source communities. So if you think of what I was telling about FDI, the distance decay is extremely steep. So here I show in a graph how much FDI can you expect from Vienna to different places in Eastern Europe. So basically you can expect some in Prague, in Budapest and Prague, but then as soon as you get to Romania or Bulgaria, there's very little FDI to be expected from a place like Vienna. Trade moves much further. And the reason is that business travel is actually very, very localized. So people don't like to travel over long distances, which has also something to do with the infrastructure that we have in place for that. Open source collaborations can be on a much longer distance. So what does that, what kind of lessons can you learn from that? Well, first, if you want to, some places will need to transform their economies. So they need to somehow create new capabilities. And that means that you need to invest in skills and actually not just in individual skills. It doesn't matter that you have a lot of people in universities, you actually need to make sure that there's a skill ecosystem. So if you train engineers, you also need to train the mechanics and everybody else that make an engineer productive. Otherwise, the engineer lacks the productive ecosystem around them. And then economies can explore the adjacent possible by looking at what is nearby in terms of these capability spaces with the aim of becoming more complex so that productivity goes up. The same with the transition to the green economy. I completely concur with the notion that investments in the green economy are paramount. They are extremely important for our energy independence. But different green has many different products and different capabilities. And you can pick from this very large menu those products and capabilities that are actually fit in your region. So you can try to analyze what are actually the opportunities in this green economy, which depends on the local economy that you're currently run. And then it is very important to raise the connectivity, to not be too peripheral, so that you can actually exchange capabilities with other places. So distance still matters, as you saw in FDI, but maybe much less so in the more online activities. But that requires still a huge investment in digitization. And the fact that we saw that these communities of programmers are clustered in very few places still means that they are looking for certain investments that allow them to carry out their job. They search each other in these cities, and then they can collaborate over long distances. Countries can invest in return migration to harness some of the capabilities that their own people learned abroad, and in smart FDI. So not just any FDI, but the FDI that will help them transform their economies. So let me stop here.
Thank you very much, Frank. It was very insightful. And I'd like to, before we open to the floor, just give the speakers the opportunity to kind of wrap up on also what they heard from the other speakers. And then, of course, as colleagues at the LSE have said, please, in the audience, feel free to pose questions directly in the chat, and I'll be reading them aloud. And also, please indicate your name and affiliation, as well as to which of the speaker the question is directed to, if you wish. Ides, getting back to you. So one recommendation from Frank is invest in skills, and he mentioned about the importance of foreign direct investment. So because we discussed that clearly the recovery fund has a strong reputational effect, clearly for those countries. What do you think an institution such as the EBRD can help recipient countries successfully mobilize private sector funding, attract indeed capital, and in a sense leverage on these funds?
Thank you, Corrado, and thank you, Frank, for that very interesting presentation. Food for thought. So in terms of mobilization, so IFIs, like EBRD, you know, one of the prime objectives for us is really to mobilize private sector investments in domestic and foreign capital in its countries of operation. And we do have very clear mobilization targets to bring in private sector financing, you know, with the help of our own balance sheet. So in the, you know, particular context of ARF funds and the way we see, you know, how to mobilize private sector funding, we can do this in several ways. So we can syndicate part of our lending with commercial banks. So for any project, we can syndicate portion, and you know, the way we do this is also by leveraging on our preferred credit status, you know, as an IFI. We have then, you know, also the ability to look firsthand at the project, do our due diligence, and, you know, banks can participate in our loan. So we remain the lender of record, and, you know, the syndicated banks then benefit also from our preferred credit status. And this loan syndication structure is really a technique that we use a lot to mobilize private sector financing. We call it AB loan structures with commercial banks. But we can also do, you know, parallel joint financing with commercial banks. We can participate in private placements. We can use, you know, sort of different guarantees, facilities, portfolio risk sharing to attract also private sector. So we have a really an array of instruments that we use to mobilize private sector, and it's really, really at the core of our mandate, as is with you know, other IFIs.
Thank you very much, Ines. When you were speaking, I was also in the meantime keeping an eye on the chat, and I want to turn to Anthony. So before, Anthony, you presented a very interesting taxonomy looking at focus, scale, and impact of those funds, and I'd like to go back to that interesting table you had, and also use that as an opportunity to ask a question from one of our attendees from the chat. So Maya Kanisa, who asked, do you think that the creation of the NGU can be a step towards a Eurobond or an innovation to replace Eurobonds? So how much do you think these represent a step into that direction? You said before, we should be careful when we speak about mutualization, fiscal mutualization when it comes to the RRF. Can you expand on that?
I'm very happy to do so. Let me give you a bit of background on what I'm trying to say. What I'm trying to say is that we have a novel new programmatic initiative at the EU level. History informs us that, you know, this has happened before and has happened successfully in terms of R&D, in terms of cohesion funds. Why it happened successfully? It happened successfully because two streams of insights were integrated. Operational experience, but also pure academic research. So what I'm proposing here is that we need to have a framework in order to have ideas like the things that Franco was suggesting, integrated in a kind of ex-ante assessment of how things will evolve. And then we need to integrate operational experience by IFIs and other colleagues. So this is the framework that I'm proposing. Now, when it comes to, you know, what is the future of this initiative, I would say that a lot of it depends on, you know, overcoming the weaknesses from the past, especially delayed implementation. I want to stress that because this is a kind of very important legacy that we need to consider and overcome in the future. But also I would say that it's important to focus on cost justification, because it's a kind of paradox when you address the market and you are not doing your homework with cost justification properly. And on the top of that, I think that the future of this initiative will really be enriched and enhanced by absorbing the experience of well-established players in financial innovation. IFIs are not discovering this area before. They have been doing it for years. They have been doing it in difficult countries. We need to incorporate that. And by incorporating that, efficiency is enhancing. And then we build momentum on the, you know, what you were suggesting before, the future of this program. One final point. I think that by having a structure like this, what are the gaps, what is the best practice, and what are the policy implications, we can really reveal important, you know, new directions. For example, if you take structure and resilience as an important dimension, and if you look to kind of low productivity segments, then the issue of non-tradables in Europe becomes prominent. And we need to see how we can tackle, you know, this problem and how we can transfer non-tradables to exporting trade non-tradables. Another thing, IFIs for years, they have been doing work on enhancing local financial capabilities at the regional level or at the municipality level. This is a kind of overlooked area in this program. And we nearly, if we are interested in the quality of investment and in the future of this initiative, we need to integrate that as much as possible. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Anthony. So I would like to go to Vedrana again. So in that sense, bridge what has been discussed so far and ask Vedrana, because you have also experience, of course, from the through the lenses of the banking sector, do you think the so you've seen clearly, or you're seeing also the other side, where do you think there could be some implementation gaps, again for sake of helping those countries strengthen or improve long-term growth potential from the private sector point of view nowadays, and what in particular Central Eastern and European countries will need distinctively to pay attention to. You hinted before at vaccination rates and clearly also the way they've approach the program. Is there anything you could say more on that?
Thank you very much for the question. So I think if we start from the success, what would make it successful? So the success would make a combination of the factors: economic structure, meaning capacity to go with the reforms alongside with the use of the funds, its absorption capacity that we saw previously with the structural investment funds, it was not always successful. also the instruments which are being used, you know, when you use grants, for which projects you go more for the concessional lending, when you create financial instruments. So the balancing of the financial instruments and structuring appropriate financing for the specific projects, it is also one of the factors of success. And finally, the investments which are being chosen. It is also important how much they will contribute to closing of the gaps, which are very much needed if we want to have more coherent European Union and more stronger. So going alongside these factors, we can definitely speak about the capacity to implement. And here is a specific area where EBRD in particular can help. And this is particularly through the engagement of the technical assistance, because the EBRD can help support this rollout of the assistance for the project preparation, also execution. It can also support the government in leading the policy reforms and also co-finance the project together with the loans or the grants which are coming from the funds. And actually, it is 12 member states that could benefit from this support, where it really strengthens the member states' capacity to implement. The second area relates to the selection of the projects. Very often we see the projects which go into the primary infrastructure, which is okay for less developed countries, but for a more developed, the question is really how much additional value is being created through those typically public infrastructure projects. I would recommend going much more in those projects which are aimed at addressing the productivity, because productivity, particularly in agricultural sector, is very weak, also in manufacturing in most of the countries. So selection of the projects will be also of the utmost importance, because this is where we see big gaps. Then, as we say, the success is really very much dependent on each country and what are the gaps in specific countries, although there are also some positive spillovers. But to come to this positive spillovers, first countries need to address their own gaps. So as example, I can take, let's say, like three countries from the Central and Southeast Europe, Bulgaria, Poland, Romania. One topic which goes for all three of them is decarbonization of the industry, whereby for Romania, there is a good potential in the hydrogen technologies, supporting investments in hydrogen technologies and also in the renewables. For Romania, the areas which are also very relevant is supporting the state-owned enterprises, their corporate governance, and making them more resilient. Also making the SMEs more digital and helping the access of the SMEs financing and helping them access the capital markets to the extent feasible given their side. For Poland, which is much more advanced country, definitely continuing support of the green transition, but also looking more specifically on the digital agenda. There is a gap on a 5G and a broadband. And for Bulgaria, country which is less developed economically than, for example, Poland, there is a still gap with regards to the water and the wastewater systems, and of course the continued need for the further decarbonization of the industry. And what I also mentioned before, with the conflict that we have currently in place and which we cannot estimate how long and what the impact on the economies is going to be, I really see the increased use for the green. The use will be really in those areas where gains are faster, and this is what the EU Commission is urging for, focusing on the areas where we can have a quicker gains to ensure that fossil fuels are being reduced as quickly as possible. And this means more clean energy production, energy efficiency, and switching from fossil gas in heating homes to electricity. So I would say that massive revamping of the renewables, biogas and hydrogen is recommended, particularly in the situation where we have a constrained, I would say, potentially constrained access and increased prices to energy sources from Russia. In terms of the role that the commercial bank can have, such as Intesa, where I'm working for, we can actually help structure the financing which is the best suited for this purpose, and also make the investments on a larger scale, which wouldn't be possible without having a grant component or some sort of a concessional funding. So, and very much similarly to EBRD, we definitely support the engagement of the private sector, because the economy can be sustainable only if both arms grow together, meaning the public and the private sector. So definitely the co-financing with the recovery and resilience funds, it has a big potential to unlock the investments that we as a commercial bank would not be able to do or not to do at such scale.
Thank you very much, Vedrana. I like to just reading from the bottom of the chat. There are two interesting, very interesting questions. One by Anthony Valion, LSE external alumnus, and then one other from Bernard Casey. Both of them tackle on the issue of conditionality. The first question in particular asks, how similar are those conditional loans as part of the EU program to the structural adjustment policies of the IMF in the 80s and 90s. And I think, without entering too much into the details of the two, of course, instruments, you know, clearly the IMF structural adjustment loans were, you know, very much centered around reducing deficit and, in a sense, liberalizing trade and, you know, dealing with balance of payment assistance. But one criticism of the structural adjustment loans was really the conditionality because of the effect on the social sector. So in that sense, I wanted to bring in Frank and ask, so before you spoke about complexity just before the pandemic hit, and how much these complexity changes after structural reform, and does it change after structural reform? Does really complexity accelerate or improves after structural reform, or is it and how long normally countries would take to kind of move along the side or closer to, say, the complexity frontier?
Well, there are extremely successful cases of that, of increasing complexity, for instance, in East Asia. And so they have had like decades of very structured moving up the complexity ladder. So I think it's it can be done. The difficulty of implementing structural transformation, like in terms of the industrial structure of the economy, is that it requires so many things to be in place, right? So things that you are not doing yet, they are not happening for a reason, right? It's an equilibrium outcome. There is a good reason why a country is not doing the things that it's not doing. It just cannot yet. So why can it not do these things? And part of that is having capabilities, but at the level of the government, you have an information problem. So you actually would like to know, which are the capabilities that are missing that are holding me back from moving in that direction that I wanted to move? So one thing that I'm not sure how the other panelists view that is to what extent one can deploy these funds in a way that they reveal information about the kind of change that is required for the country to move on. So let's say, I see that a certain industry is failing in my economy. If a bank gives it money and just realizes that they go bankrupt, the information about why the bankruptcy happened might stay with the bank. Is there a way to feed it back into the government so that they actually understand what kind of constraints need to be relieved to help this this progress and next time not to, to make the same mistake? So I think information revelation in funding might be an important aspect to move on the complexity ladder as well, given that the government is actually a very active participant in providing capabilities apart from the private sector. It's not just the private sector, it's also the public sector.
Thank you very much, Frank. So it kind of led naturally to that question. So to the panelists, and I'd like to first go to Ines, if I may, about what this information revelation, how important it is to to feedback the information to the government in terms of identifying investment priority areas, but also tying that up with a question from Bernard Kazi in terms of monitoring. So what happens when things go wrong, and is there any reputational effect you think, and can you essentially guide us through that both reputationally and operationally, what the process really is for an institution such as a big bank such as the EBRD?
Sure. Yeah, it's very very good question, Bernard. So there's obviously high expectations, for the role that RRF funds will play, to boost the European economy. And it's a very good question in terms of, what do you do if, things don't go as planned. So what we have decided to do is to actually opt for tranching mechanisms. We do it in sort of tranches and sections. And so each subsequent installment would only be dispersed, if the previous one has had, success. So there is this sort of tranching mechanism that's embedded in the process, which I think is useful. And also don't forget, there will be quite a lot of due diligence in terms of even the project selection itself. So, we need to make sure that the project is the right project for us to be doing, and we believe in the targets, and that the targets are achievable. But the program itself is also meant to leave the member states and the private sector and the IFIs in the driving seat. So I think that that is a good thing. So the ownership really does stay with the member states and not so much the Commission. So by tranching and by project selection, we hope to minimize the risk of not achieving the targets.
Thank you very much, Ines. I think that answers the question very clearly. And for sake of understanding really operationally how the program works, I wanted, without wanting to put him in the spotlight, to ask Renato, if I may, that I have to thank especially him because he helped me put together the event. But before Ines mentioned that clearly Greece is a successful example of deployment funds, and I know you worked first hands on the Greek program. What do you think made Greece particularly a successful case in that context? What you can share with the board?
Thank you, Corrado, and I will build also on my recent experience as a secondi in our Athens resident office for a few months. I think that from the very start, the Greek government had very clear priorities of what they want to achieve with the recovery funds. They even used a Nobel Prize laureate in economics to set up recommendations, not only on the investments, but mainly on the reform side of the economy. And I think that was a very clear understanding of what held Greece back for so long. I think also Greece had a very peculiar problem from the start, which was a very high cost of funding. And therefore, the fact that they didn't just go for the grants, but also for the loans was justified by the fact that compared to most businesses, not only SMEs, but even mid-caps and larger corporates, they were really receiving when receiving it all, very high interest rate. So I think the impact of the program certainly has been magnified by the starting condition. And I think, as Vedrana said before, the fact that other European countries were for so long, and Greece in particular, under very strict, in a way, monitoring and reviews of the private sector markets, but also of the European Commission and peer member states, that made them, I think, from the very start, understanding very well how to work with the Commission. We shouldn't forget that for many years under the Troika, the Commission had a big team in Athens. And that, I think, at the beginning was perceived as a bit of a control function. But I think over time, they certainly saw also the positive effects of working in tandem together with so many also different units of the Commission. So whether it was on the green agenda, whether it was on state aid and competition with DG Comp, whether it was more on economic assessments with DG ECFIN, I think that really gave them a head start, if anything. And I think also, linking to the economic complexity point that Frank made, the Greeks were quite smart to not only go with the green and digital priorities that are horizontal and more or less like similar across all the EU member states, but also they picked three strategic priorities, very Greek specifics, around moving up the value chain and becoming or helping their firms to become more export-oriented, more competitive. I would say also more R&D intensive in a way, and certainly more linked to supply chains. Now, whether the economic geography will be on their side, we shall see. Certainly, there are pros and cons in their position. I think if you consider the FDIs from Germany, it's true that Greece doesn't have the same proximity as Slovakia or Czech Republic or other countries that EBRD invests currently with much success, especially in the automotive sector, for example. But on the other hand, Greece does have some advantages from the geography point of view. And here I would think of renewable energy, so solar and wind, for example. So there are certainly some good advantages that the hope is that they will be fully implemented with this new initiative. Time will say.
Yeah, thanks very much for that, Renato. And I think that really blends nicely with what has been discussed. Starting conditions do matter, and it is very important really to acknowledge that when we think about, you know, both structural reform, but also, you know, the extent to which those countries can these, you know, investment in skills in and attract private sector funding. I'd like just to turn again to the audience and invite any sort of questions they might have before we wrap up the event. Having said that, I think, you know, the main takeaway really are that, you know, it is a very complex program, and certainly so the current event, you know, that have a very strong political implications such as Russian-Ukraine conflict carry a very heavy weight when it comes to thinking about energy independence and energy efficiency of Europe. For instance, just to bring in some of the current simulations that we've done at the National Institute of Economic and Social Research, we've found that, you know, if Russia were to sort of pull the plug and sort of oil supply should stop, then the EU would really risk being pushed into a recession. So it is, I think, as timely as ever for the EU to invest in this transition, both green and digital. So if there are no other questions, I'd just like to ask the panelists if they had any final remarks before we close the event. Or any reactions to what has been said by other panelists, please feel free to jump in. If not, I'd like to thank the colleagues at the LSE for the support. It has been a great pleasure to have the opportunity for both me and I think all of you to listen to our speakers today. Thank for the speakers for such an excellent discussion, and to all of you in the audience for listening. Thanks again also to Renato Giacon, EBRD, for helping us put together the excellent discussion.